The Department of Religious Studies at the University of Kansas is conducting a research project that seeks to preserve the history of various churches and other religious organizations in Kansas. We would like to record your memories of your experiences in religious organizations. We expect that each interview will take about 1 hour or shorter. We assure you that you are not obligated to participate and may discontinue your involvement at any time. And since we are trying to create a public record of Kansas religious history, we are primarily interviewing persons who agree to let their interviews be available to the general public through a website and to be identified by name as the person who was interviewed. So do I have your consent to continue?
Yes.
Is that okay? Okay. Yeah. Just my first question is, in what churches or other religious organizations have you participated?
Cultural background and religious background is Missouri Synod Lutheran.
Okay.
And it's really tied to a cultural group. It's very much German.
Okay.
And so my grandmother and grandfather were both full-blooded Germans who settled in western Kansas and studied or were members and participated in the Missouri Synod Lutheran Church.
Okay. So have you personally participated, like, in
yes.
you still?
No.
No.
Yes, I did. That was my mother's parents,
mm-hmm.
and so my mother was very much Missouri Synod Lutheran,
mm-hmm.
and I went to I did not live in Kansas at the time, but my parents relocated to Houston,
mm-hmm.
and I was born and raised in Houston, but I was in a Missouri Synod Lutheran school from K through 8, no,
okay.
K through 6, excuse
okay.
me. And then I went to a private Lutheran college in Concordia Lutheran Teachers College in Seward, Nebraska, when I graduated from high school. So I went right back into that Missouri Synod Lutheran
yeah.
denomination and got my undergraduate degree
okay.
in education and theology. So I majored in theology,
mm-hmm.
and then I worked in a that's right, I do have that history. I worked in as a director of Christian education in a Missouri Synod Lutheran church in Kansas for about 5 years
okay.
before getting out of the church and moving into social work.
Okay.
That's a long answer. Sorry.
Why were people attracted to this religious body?
I think it was very much as much about culture as it was about mm-hmm. religion. And if you'd asked me that as a child, I'm not sure
mm-hmm.
I could have articulated that. But the German people that I was around were very rigid, or to say it positively, very structured
okay.
in the way they lived their lives, very organized. And the Missouri Synod Lutheran Church it's not the most conservative Lutheran tradition, but it's close.
Mm-hmm.
There's like the Wisconsin Synod, and then there's a Missouri mm-hmm. Synod. And they, for example, don't ordain women. They have their liturgy looks very Catholic.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Looks almost exactly like what you would see in a Catholic church.
Okay.
And they're aligned more so with Catholicism,
mm-hmm.
although their priests are not, their pastors are not celibate.
Okay.
But there's a very similar, and they actually distinguish themselves as from the rest of Protestantism. You know,
mm-hmm.
they identify with that Martin Luther's Reformation and
okay.
the nailing of the 95 Theses on the door at the church in Wittenberg, and they view themselves as not Catholic, but also not, they don't identify with the rest of Protestantism.
Okay.
They have their own special set of beliefs. But your question was, say your question again.
Why were people attracted to this religious body?
So I think for me, and I think for a lot of people, it was what you had grown up with or
mm-hmm.
what it was, the family of your culture, your background, your tradition. And so that's what I think drew a lot of folks in. I'm not sure, and maybe people were drawn into the actual beliefs, but I don't think I understood their beliefs around women even until I started working in the church.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I really got it. And when I began to work in the church, I began to realize they had very conservative views of women. And that was the departure. That was the beginning of my leaving the
okay,
church
so
because
of that.
That
was one of the reasons why you
right,
left. Okay.
Right.
Do you currently practice with any religious bodies?
No, I do not.
Okay.
And I had a really ugly set of experiences in the Lutheran church. Mm-hmm. I was involved in helping to defrock the pastor that worked there because he was sexually inappropriate and had been sexually inappropriate with several women in the parish. And so I ended up being one of the women, young women in my 20s, whose early 20s, who spoke up. And through that process, he had been in the pastoral ministry for over 20 years, and he was actually defrocked and removed from the church.
Wow.
Right. What a history, right?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's a really intense set of experiences, and that was in it would have been 1985, 86.
Okay.
So that was way before the huge scandals began to emerge about inappropriate behavior among clergy and other pastors across multiple denominations with not only children, but what often is ignored is that a lot goes on with girls and with women.
Mm-hmm.
And the churches have tended to minimize the abuse that has gone on with women. Yeah.
That was actually one of my questions. Can you speak more on just the scandals that happened in there? Like, I'm not really that familiar with, I'm Methodist, so I'm not really that familiar with the Lutheran. We actually had someone come into class the other day for this class and spoke a little bit about it, but he didn't really bring up anything with scandals because he was a guy, so I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
They're just...
Maybe he had a different kind of experience. So when you... I also was involved in helping to... I worked with another pastor and left that church and worked with another pastor from the ELCA that was just across the border in Kansas City, Missouri, and similar issues occurred, and that gentleman was also defrocked. So in about a five-year period, I had had two experiences with folks, leaders I had known, and both were stripped of their leadership roles, and it profoundly affected my view of faith and religion.
Mm-hmm.
How could it not?
Yeah.
You know? Wow. But you're asking me, so what about, what is, you're
more
asking?
Of, like, what was my question?
What?
Like, what kind of norms and expectations were there for sexual behavior? Were there penalties for violation of those rules? And were there any sex scandals?
Well, clearly there were sex scandals. And there is a, in the Missouri Synod Lutheran Church, all the elders are male.
Okay.
So, and they're divided into districts is what they call them instead of dioceses, which is what you might see in the Catholic Church. So there were the Kansas district of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod had its own district, so it had its own district leadership. And then the churches, all the pastors and leaders of all those churches, including DCEs, like I was a DCE, would come to meetings and conferences where we would interact with each other, support one another, study scripture, talk about our leadership roles. So so there was a pretty, but it was almost all of it was male. I was one of three women in the state who was doing what I was doing at the time. Everyone else in a leadership position was male, and there was sharp divide over whether the church should even do that, should even have women in. You know, some were called ministers of Christian education, which was even considered a little bit heretical. It was one thing to call them directors of Christian education, quite another to refer to them as ministers. So let's see if I can answer your question. So, and I'll give you an example about sexuality in the church. I did children's sermons in church pretty much every Sunday.
Okay.
And that meant, there's a time in the service where the kids would all come up front, and I was usually doing some kind of an object lesson, where I would use some kind of, I'd have, an animal or a picture or something to help make the idea come alive to the students, to the kids, to these little kids. They're little kids under the age of five, primarily.
Yeah.
So they would come up front, and the sanctuary was set up in such a way, it's very much that, where everybody is in two rows, men and women together, so they didn't separate men from women in that fashion. And then you had an aisle down the center, and you had the sanctuary part where the altar was up front. And I would sit right in front of the altar, facing the congregation, and the kids would come up. Well, there was only like one step, so it was a really an awkward place to sit. And I never wore a skirt or a dress when I was doing the children's sermon because there was no way to do that gracefully.
Yeah.
And so I can remember distinctly wearing a pair of slacks like I would normally wear, doing the children's sermon, and having elders come up to me after the sermon, and an elder had actually complained because he thought he could see my genitals, literally said that to me, too easily, even in the position I was sitting in. And what initially occurred was one main elder had said that to me, and I said, who is the person who's saying this to me? I want to talk to the person who's saying this to me. When they finally brought the gentleman over, another elder, he couldn't even look me in the face to say that to me. And then it was nothing further was done with it, because I said to him, how else am I supposed to do this? And at the time, I was maybe 23, and I didn't know what I would, what I know now, which would be to say, looks to me like, this is what I would have said now. Looks to me like you're the one with the problem, not me. But at 23, 24, you don't know, and it's almost like it's not okay to question. So you shouldn't even be asking those questions of the leadership. Another piece of what happened was when the scandal broke loose in that particular church, which is in Kansas, only an hour from here, is that one of the things, I'll never forget this, because they said to me, well, if you want to talk to someone about what has happened within our, and want to talk to someone within the denomination, we'll be more than willing to set you up so you can talk to another male pastor about what happened to you. And even at that point, I was able to say, are you kidding me? Have you, you know, do you not get that here I am having to deal with a man who was a pastor who'd been abusive, and then you want to link me up with another male person in leadership? And they didn't have any women in leadership that could have even spoken to me about my experience, because there weren't any. And so looking back on that, I can really see now how unable they were to respond to the issues that they were facing. They began to more in-depth face in their church. I also, the pastor that was defrocked was then replaced with another pastor who then had his whole family with him. You know, they have a parsonage usually. And so the church is actually paying for the place for where they're staying. That was true with all the pastors, which created some hardship for them if they ever left the ministry or retired. But this guy that followed the pastor that got defrocked came out as gay in the middle of the, you know, within like the first 3 to 4 years. Well, you can imagine how that went over. That church was just devastated, and they kicked him out. Within a very brief time, somebody saw him in Kansas City, downtown Kansas City, with another man. And that's how the scandal broke. And so the church's response to that was just to also defrock him also. Because that's completely unacceptable in that denomination, that if you were homosexual, if you were not heterosexual. And here he is then. Can you imagine having to then somehow deal with his family in the context of this religious organization? I guess
it's crazy.
Well, it's absolutely, and I think it, when I saw the limits of the church's ability, there are a couple things. One is, I don't think churches are equipped to deal with sexuality. And you have, and I mean sexuality in a broad way. So you have lots of women and other people. Women are the largest percentage of people who ever seek help. So I'm just referring to women. But you have the first place that people often go when they're having some kind of, when they're emotionally distraught or facing some kind of difficulty, is their church, and is to speak to their pastor. We have huge numbers of people, huge numbers of women, 1 out of 4, that are having to deal with some kind of sexual assault, domestic violence, intimate partner violence, however you want to frame it. Mm-hmm. And our churches and our leadership are this is just incenses me, are ill-equipped to provide support and services. And quite often, it's not unusual to hear them say that they will tell the woman, and I saw that happen in my own denomination when I was working there, where the pastor told the woman that she needed to basically suck it up and make it work even when she was in a violent situation. And I think that's the part for me. And I actually have tried to work with our Missouri Synod leadership to get them to consider doing more with education around sexuality in a broad way, not just around sexual intercourse, but around what is intimacy, learning how to deal with feeling close to someone if you're in a leadership position and you're working with a parishioner. Those kinds of things are not being addressed. How do you manage touch? It's almost like the kinds of things we talk about in social work classes. Mm-hmm. These folks are not, and this first pastor that I work with went to KU and all but finished his master's in counseling psych. And I think he knew good and well that if he had finished his degree, he would have been held liable and accountable, not from his church, but from a licensing body in a totally different discipline or profession that would have held him accountable, and he could have been sued. And he could have lost his license and would have been unable to practice. And I think he held off from getting that license. I think in part knew that that would make him accountable, and this way he could get away with things that he couldn't do in other contexts. I think that's the other thing that really I find troublesome, is that somehow leadership is not accountable. They're not accountable to the people they're serving, nor are they. There's no accountability for their behavior. They can continue to do what they're doing. And no one will say, that's not okay, you can't do that. You either need to get help, because I do think people can heal and change, or you need to get out of what you're doing. I guess I have that's funny that Ed asked me, because it's been a long time since I've talked about it. And up until probably even, I would say, 5 years ago, it was so emotional for me, I could not articulate how I felt. It was just really difficult for me. And since that time, since really making a move into social work and doing some of my own personal work around those issues, has gotten a lot better. But it's not because of what happened, what I experienced in the church, that makes me leave the church. It's because of the church's ongoing refusal to address issues of intimacy, emotional intimacy, sexuality, to help really educate their leadership. They refuse to educate their leadership. And they don't think it's important enough. And yet here they've got all these scandals and issues going on. I find that it's unacceptable to me.
Yeah.
And I just will not participate in what I see as doing more harm than good. And it's really difficult because it was the church of my family, my home, my childhood. And it was very, very difficult for me to leave that. It's taken me a very long time to separate from the church.
Do you see that religious body as like growing and changing? Do you think that they have changed since that you've left, or do you think that it's still the same?
I think it's the same. And I'll tell you why I think it's the same. I ended up developing, renewing a relationship with a faculty member who I had had as a student when I was 18 in the Missouri Synod Lutheran Church, and he finished out his career at Valparaiso University. We just played them in basketball last night. And actually, the pastor who married us was the president of Valparaiso up until a couple of years ago, and who married my husband and I, and one of the key men, second men in Valparaiso underneath him, is the person I'm referring to.
Oh, okay.
So these two men are in major leadership positions in what is supposed to be a little bit more, it can have Missouri Synod students in that college, but that college also takes the more liberal Lutheran denomination, ELCA, for example.
Okay.
And then they also have students that are Catholic. So they have kind of a broad range of students from differing religious groups. I spent probably a couple years interacting with the second man in charge and talking with him about these very issues. And he's actually still at 72, still involved in working with ministers and directors of Christian education. He headed up the program. He headed up the program and continues to provide leadership to that program. And they spend a half a day out of their entire time in training doing anything with sexuality, and he doesn't see it as that important. And even after extensive dialogue, probably over a couple of years, of saying, isn't this something you could consider? Look at what happened in my context, what's happened with other people, other women, other other men. Can't there be some movement here? There's absolutely, and I just ended that dialogue probably within a year ago. So I really made an effort. You know, it had been 20 years since I'd been, or 15, no, 20 years since I'd been through that experience in the church. And I came back to that issue and rekindled relationships, in part not only to tell my story, but in hopes that there might be some movement in the church. And it also was in the hopes of renewing my own faith. And although we developed a nice relationship, or we, at that point, at one point we had, we could talk with each other, there was no give and no interest in changing what goes on, and he's in a position to make those changes.
Definitely.
And so I really tried to go out of my way to do some advocacy, and it went absolutely nowhere. Absolutely nowhere. And it's just so just really disheartening. You know, that there's no movement. There's no, I just don't think, you have huge numbers of men in leadership. And so men, you know, even my husband, my love dearly, does not get the issues around sexual harassment. Or that women might have a very different experience than men do in the same circumstance, just because they're women. And there's no explaining that. It's very difficult to explain that to someone of a different gender. And until those churches are willing to open up their leadership or dialogue to much larger groups of women and people with varying experiences like gay and lesbian folks, it's never going to happen. I have another experience where I sent him a book I was developing. We were talking about leadership, and I sent him, I have it on my shelf. It's The Courage to Heal up in the top corner. It's really, you know, like core book, two women who write about issues around sexual abuse and assault, especially childhood familial sexual abuse. But it's really central information. I was trying to explain to this leader how prominent abuses in our of women is, you know, one out of four over by the time they're 18. And I was doing this process of educating him, and he said, well, send me something. And I sent him this book, and he said, it looks to me like these are two lesbian women that have written the book. On he looked at the back cover, and his response was, I'm not going to read anything written by lesbian women. And I got right up in his face and said, how do you know that the men you're reading or the other people you're reading are in the midst of affairs? How do you know they're not closeted gays, gay people? I mean, how can you make it a judgment about something you're going to read or not read based on someone's sexual orientation? So that's another example to me of the church's views of sexuality, or, their views of sexuality. And one of the other things that happened, I hope it's okay that I
this is
okay. Well, one of the other things that happened was one of the women I went through the Director of Christian Education program with, which this guy headed up, the guy from Valparaiso, whom I'll call Bill. So Bill had been the head of this program at Concordia Lutheran Teachers College in Seward, Nebraska. And one of the women, I'll call her Deborah, had been in the program with me. And Bill had said to me, well, why don't you connect with her? She's still, she's in academia. She was in an academic position in the Deep South, in Mississippi, of all places. So I thought, well, this would be great. I'll renew this connection. Maybe something will come of it. Well, clearly, Bill didn't know much about her, because when I, he really didn't know much about her, because when I called up and, or I emailed her, and then we set up a time to chat, I found out over the course of interacting with her that she had realized she was lesbian, and she came out when she was in Mississippi in an academic position. She had left the church. She'd been in the same position I had been in, another church, and had left the Missouri Synod and had gotten into academia and had taken a position down south. And in the process of leaving the church, she said it was the first time she'd really been able to explore her sexuality because the church had put that so off limits. It was not okay. And when she was able to really take a look at that, she realized she really was lesbian, and now in her 40s is having the first relationship that she's ever had with a partner. And she really attributes the delay in her growth and exploration of who she is in relationships due to, in large measure, because of her involvement in the church and her work in the church. The other thing that I thought was awful was that when she came out to her mother, who was in her late 70s or early 80s, her mother went to a Missouri Synod Lutheran pastor. Again, this is the first place people are going to get support and help is often their church. So this elderly woman goes to her pastor to talk about the fact that her daughter has come out to her. And the pastor advises the mother to have no contact with her daughter, to cut off contact.
Wow.
It was just devastating to Deborah, just devastating. And I ended up confronting Bill about that because I said, how is this okay?
Yeah.
If you have no contact, you have no opportunity to change things. But this is your stance. And I said, what right does that pastor have to intervene in that daughter and mother's relationship? It's totally wrong-headed.
Yeah.
But he felt like it was his authority and that was his calling to do that. I'm sure that's what that was about. So anyway.
No, that's just interesting, just because here in the Methodist Church, the church that I attend here in Lawrence, it's very open. We're like, last week they just had a panel for transgendered people. So do you think that even, you know, say a couple of years with like my generation and the generation below, like generations below me, do you ever think that the Missouri Synod Lutheran Church might change their aspect? I mean, the elders will always be there, but do you think that?
Well, you know, have you heard of this thing called altar and pulpit fellowship? This is a term they use in the Missouri Synod to determine who they will have communion with, for example, or who they will preach with, at whose church or denomination they will preach with. Unlike the ELCA, which is the more liberal, one of the more liberal, bigger denominations in the Lutheran Church, the ELCA, for example, I know has said, we're going to have altar and pulpit fellowship with the Episcopalian Church.
Okay.
We see enough in common, we will begin to connect and involve, you know, interact with folks from this denomination in a deeper way, you know, around our rituals or customs. The Missouri Synod refuses to engage in altar and pulpit fellowship with a church like the Episcopalian Church. So that should give you, and that's recent, that should give you a sense. It's almost like, it almost feels like the right wing, the Tea Party, the right wing of the Tea Party. It's like they've, instead of like moving towards the middle, they've moved even further toward an extreme position. Now, I know the mainline churches are losing members in droves. And I don't know if over time, this type of church, this really conservative church, will just wane out. It will just die out.
Yeah.
Because will the younger people just refuse to participate? I mean, they're just not going to. However, that's not the case with a denomination like the Mennonite people, and they've managed to maintain very conservative religious views. My husband and I, my husband grew up on a farm in Nebraska. He is Missouri Synod Lutheran and grew up Missouri Synod Lutheran, and they grew up in farming communities next to Mennonite people.
Okay.
So, in some ways, very similar views about the role of women, about real conservative, strict views of sexuality, unwillingness to talk about sexual or intimacy issues just in general. So you're asking me, do I think they'll move more towards the center or change? I'm not hopeful. And I actually thought, you know, and now I look at it, I'm not going to beat myself up thinking that maybe there might be room for a change. But my own experience has borne out that that's not. I mean, I've been involved with that church for 30 years, off and on for 30 years, and I don't see movement. There are people in that church that are more open. leaders in that church,
yeah.
individuals.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't see the denomination as a whole, like in their policies and in their where they stand officially. I don't see that moving. But I do see people within the denomination. I still maintain a fairly close relationship with one of the pastors in Kansas City, Kansas,
mm-hmm.
who's in the inner city, which
mm-hmm.
I think also shapes you. Because when you see poverty and violence, he works actually for the police department, and he's on call for the police department. His wife got her master's degree in social work from here.
Mm.
He's a different breed, and he is a Missouri Synod Lutheran pastor,
mm-hmm.
but I think he's rare. His views have been like that since I've known him since he was in his 30s.
Mm-hmm.
That hasn't changed. So there are people, there are pockets of people that are not like that, but I would say by and large, what you're going to see is a really conservative, not
mm-hmm.
only leadership, but laity.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't mean to. No, it's okay.
That's okay. This is just what I needed. how were children handled? Were there any educational programs for the children or other activities?
Yes, as a matter of fact, as a minister or director of Christian education, that was a huge component of my job.
Mm-hmm.
And the Missouri Synod, or the Lutheran Church in particular, does or has done confirmation between 7th and 8th grade. So 2 years of instruction
mm-hmm.
On the catechism and on, it would be on scripture too, but it was more about Lutheran teachings and doctrine, so you were learning the creeds, the Nicene Creed,
mm-hmm.
the Athanasian Creed. I don't even remember all those creeds, but you had to be able to memorize scripture. As a child, I had to memorize scripture and memorize those creeds.
Wow.
And that was part of the testing I had to do in order to become a full member of the church. And I did that in 8th grade.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some of the Missouri Synod Lutheran churches, you see some shift toward 5th and 6th grade, which is what the liberal denomination of the Lutheran Missouri
mm-hmm.
Synod, or the Lutheran ELCA has done. But that's... I don't think that cuts across all the Missouri
mm-hmm.
Synod churches. I think some have done that, and some have said no, that we're going to wait till they're in 7th and 8th grade. I worked also, I taught school. I taught 8th grade in the Missouri Synod Lutheran School when I
mm-hmm.
finished at the church, and I quit when
mm-hmm.
I was pregnant
mm-hmm.
with our first child in 1986. And so in that year, the pastor that was at this particular church had a brain tumor. And they let me, and it really was in quotes, let me teach confirmation to the 7th and 8th grade kids because the pastor couldn't, and they
mm-hmm.
were hard up to find someone to fill that role. But it was truly a let me because, number one, I was a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And number two, I was not a full-blown pastor
mm-hmm.
in the sense that they thought I should be. Now, I think some of that is lessened where there are ministers and directors of Christian education who do teach confirmation.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, by and large, those are still men that are doing that. That it's somehow, it shouldn't be women
mm-hmm.
doing that instruction for our kids.
Mm-hmm.
It's okay if they teach English
yeah.
or math,
yeah.
but not religion. And I majored in theology,
mm-hmm.
so I still remember, I didn't get it even at that time. I got through the program, the 5-year program we had at Concordia,
mm-hmm.
and I remember a pastor, he was one of my professors, saying to me, I don't know why you're interested in getting a major in theology and reading these intellectual and philosophical books because you're not going to be able to do anything with this material,
wow.
with this learning.
Wow.
And I, at the time, I thought, what is he talking about?
Yeah.
It was like it had not registered with me, and I was 20 when I finished
mm-hmm.
an undergrad program, and it wasn't until I got into the church that I thought, oh, now I get it.
Mm-hmm.
So I lasted 5 years and then worked in that business of defrocking that pastor, and by the time that was done and they had gotten rid of him, I ended up quitting,
mm-hmm.
you know, out of that experience. I mean, it wasn't out of that.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah.
Were there any educational programs for adults, like apart from a regular worship service?
Absolutely, and as a director and minister of Christian education, I went to Bethel Bible Training up in Wisconsin,
mm-hmm.
and we did this where they used these visual images of different sections of the Bible, and we
mm-hmm.
went through the entire Bible together, and I trained groups of people, groups of the laity,
mm-hmm.
men and women, to and then they it was train the trainer. So you trained them, and they in turn passed on and had groups of their own. And so it was like one of those things where they it was pretty intensive educational experience for the adults in that were just members of the church. And there was also, I don't think we did this, but in the Missouri Synod, you've heard of the Stevens Ministry. It's a ministry where the laity are trained to actually provide beginning supportive counseling. They're not doing counseling full-blown, but they might go and visit the sick. They might see a shut-in, an older person who's not able to get out.
Mm-hmm.
And so they would educate or work with the adults to help spread out what, because the pastors were stretched and they couldn't do all the visiting, and so the adults would get involved in doing the visitation also. And so they educated or trained them, and I actually didn't work directly with that, but knew directors of Christian education
mm-hmm.
who were doing that. The other thing is we had a really active youth group, and we would go on weekend retreats
mm-hmm.
where we would plan workshops. I'd bring in other adults, usually parents, but not always.
Mm-hmm.
And we would do things like on grief and loss. Or we'd do stuff on self-esteem and maybe
mm-hmm.
address something like drug abuse.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a ton of like educational opportunities for kids as well as adults. And actually, DCEs, or Ministers of Christian Education, were actually developed in the Missouri Synod in order to provide a more enriched educational experience across all ages.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Kind of nice. I mean, I like the idea.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
How were new members recruited, and what was the process of joining?
Well, you had to go through confirmation
mm-hmm.
even if you were an adult. And I would say there was evangelism done, but even in the Missouri Synod, it's not in the way that you see it in some of the other
mm-hmm.
denominations. So it would more be like maybe a family would bring another family to church.
Okay.
So it was much more, and there was a belief that it was through relationship that you might be able to bring in members. It was
mm-hmm.
not a door-to-door,
mm-hmm.
let me give you a pamphlet kind
mm-hmm.
of thing. They really almost kind of frowned on that
mm-hmm.
kind of evangelism and saw it as not productive
mm-hmm.
and not a good way to recruit people for membership or to bring in membership. So it was through word of mouth and through relationship and not through evangelism that we see where people are knocking on doors.
Yeah.
They did do some of that, but that was not a major component of
mm-hmm.
that denomination. And you can see, I think that German piece comes out. You don't
yeah.
just knock on people's door.
Yeah.
It's wrong. It's really wrong. Well, you're invading their privacy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not okay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they need to give you permission for you to be there. And it's really, I think that has its roots in part in that German
mm-hmm.
culture. I'm sure other cultures are like that too.
Mm-hmm.
Other ethnic groups are like that. But certainly that was true with this group.
Did they have any sort of like baptisms or anything like that, or was it just primarily confirmation?
No, and baptism was at birth. So,
oh, wow.
You know, in the Lutheran Church, this is where it gets so funny. They're different than the rest of Protestantism.
Okay.
In that, for example, or I think there's a big distinction in that they believe that faith is a free gift that you can't earn. It's only through grace, and so baptism is the place where you go to receive God's grace, and it isn't about your free will. You can't
mm-hmm.
participate in it anyway, so we can baptize people when they're infants, because it isn't about making a decision to to believe.
Mm-hmm.
Matter of fact, they really frowned on that and thought that was a slap in the face of the notion of grace,
mm-hmm.
what it meant to receive God's grace. What else about that? The other thing about that they used to believe that they started to move away from was if a baby died before being baptized, that baby would end up in hell. And it used to be the pastors used that language and talked that way. It was devastating for young families when they lost a child because that child would end up in hell if it didn't have that baptism. And over time, they moved away from that strict belief. In the time that I was in that church
mm-hmm.
and knew it, you saw some of that still going on, but I heard pastors talk about the move away from that belief.
Well, I was baptized as an infant, and then I was reconfirmed after I took confirmation. And that's just something that the Methodist
Church
does. That's
what the Methodist Church does.
Yeah. That's just crazy.
It's just nuts. When I forget that I know, you know, it's like nobody asked me about this, so I don't, it's not something I'm, no, it's, no one apologizes. It's like, oh yeah, I do remember how that works. Mm-hmm. I forgot, but I remember.
Were there treatment programs for drug or alcohol abuse or physical or mental abuse?
No.
Okay.
No. That, as a matter of fact, there was a real criticism of the term social gospel in the Missouri Synod Lutheran Church.
Okay.
So, do you know what I mean when I say social gospel? A really quick idea or quick view of that is that you don't, it isn't about serving the poor or about feeding or clothing people that don't have food or don't have shelter. That our mission is not about that. Our mission is about sharing the good news with people. But this, and this social, and they called it crap. I mean, they would get really angry about the church's, that the church's mission did not involve what I would consider social work, social work things, values, and many churches view as really important to their mission. I taught in that Lutheran school for a year, remember when I was telling you about that? And I taught her in eighth grade. I remember we had a, and this is an example of this, we had a child who was sucking an eighth grader sucking his thumb in the classroom in my closet, and he was going into the closet to suck his thumb. He'd get upset and he'd crawl into the closet. So you knew there were some really deep-seated issues. And I was a young, I was pregnant and teaching, and I, so I would have been about 27 years old. And I said to the principal of the Missouri Synod Lutheran School, I said, I'm really concerned about this kid. I think we need to talk to his family because there's more going on here, and the class, I can't do, I only had like 7 or 8 students, but it might as well have been that I had 20 or 30, because this kid was, took up so much time, was so time consuming. His remark to me was telling. He said, we're not going to be involved with family, you are not a social worker, you do not do that in the school here.
Wow.
Stop it. And I thought it was such a it was a foretelling of things to come, with because within a year I was in the MSW program at KU and had left the Lutheran, you know, working in the Lutheran church. But I can't, I just, I don't get that.
Yeah.
But they so they have this real separation between personal needs and faith. Yeah.
Did that school have a counselor at it?
No.
Okay.
No. And it's still in operation today. And when I taught at that school, it was over 100 years old.
Wow.
Right.
Wow.
And it literally is in a town of less than an hour from Lawrence.
Really?
Yes.
Okay. It's interesting.
I don't know if I should say where, because then, you know, it's like that business about then you know.
Yeah.
The church I was, you would be able to identify the church.
Okay.
That I, where the, all that happened.
Yeah. How did members of the religious group interact with other members of the general public? Are there any differences?
No, I don't. You know, the other message you got in that denomination was you're supposed to be. That's interesting because it's kind of a mixed signal, isn't it?
Yeah.
You're not interested in the social gospel. You don't want to reach out to people in that way. But they also felt that part of your service was to be in the world. You're not of the world. Matter of fact, that was said quite often. You're not of the world, but you need to be in the world as a light, as salt, whatever it is. And that's how you serve, and that's how you witness, is by example. It's not by talking. It's by doing and acting. And so their view was not a huge separation between secular and sacred. As a matter of fact, they were one and the same. Whereas you see in some of these other denominations, especially more fundamentalist denominations, as I understand them, there's a huge separation between people that are of faith and those that aren't. Matter of fact, yeah, just leave it like that.
Okay.
That's enough.
What kind of practices were involved in the group, such as like rituals or ceremonies, besides just worship?
So besides worship, there was communion.
Okay.
There was confirmation. Communion and communion itself was a ritual.
Mm-hmm.
There was baptism. So we have the sacraments,
mm-hmm.
but we don't have quite as many as the Catholics do.
Mm-hmm.
As Catholics do. So we still had communion and which you couldn't take until you'd had confirmation.
Okay.
And then you had baptism, which would be a sacrament. We also viewed the fellowship of the believers as a place where the Spirit could be spread. And that was actually considered a sacrament, the communion of the saints, as they refer to it in one of the creeds, which I think is kind of a cool
mm-hmm.
notion, and I always thought that was a little bit more open and freeing
mm-hmm.
than the other ways I saw the church believing in God, where God's presence would be.
Mm-hmm.
As a director of Christian education, we actually celebrated the Passover Seder and put it in the light of Christ. And so I was involved in helping to kind of renew that ritual and got the pastor involved in doing that. We celebrate Lent and have services on Wednesday, you know, like Wednesdays
mm-hmm.
in the midweek. We also
mm-hmm.
celebrate Christmas and have Advent
mm-hmm.
services. We had the Easter celebration, you know, the day before, what is it, Good Friday?
Mm-hmm.
We had the Tenebrae service, which I always thought was really cool, which is the period of darkness between Jesus' death and before
wow.
he actually
okay.
rises from the dead on
that's
Sunday
cool.
or whatever, you
yeah.
know.
Yeah.
And so they actually, at the end of the Good Friday service, had this huge Bible and they would slam the book shut. And there was this, like, so this symbolism about, okay, all is lost,
mm-hmm.
God is dead,
mm-hmm.
and then the celebration on Easter morning, which I thought was really cool.
That is cool. I've never heard of that.
Well, and I think that's true in the, you might see that in some Catholic
okay.
churches also, so that might be closer. There was a thing, there was a difference between what they called, they had this thing called high church and low church.
Mm.
So high church in the Missouri Synod Lutheran Church had many more, like, rituals.
Okay.
So another ritual was we had altar boys and girls.
Mm-hmm.
That was a big deal, to have altar girls, and they finally did
mm-hmm.
move to that in my life, in my time of being there. And what they also would do, the altar boys or girls had a, they would hold crucifixes, you know, that they would carry down, not huge, not heavy, but
yeah.
like candles and crucifixes. The crucifixes they would hold when the person, usually the pastor, was reading the gospel, because they would read the Old Testament
uh-huh.
scripture, the
mm-hmm.
New Testament scripture, and the gospel. The kid who was holding the crucifix would stand in the middle of the church, and the people would all turn toward the crucifix, and the pastor would come down with the Bible and read the gospel in
wow.
the center of the church, which I thought was a really cool ritual. So I like that
yeah.
kind of turning in, and I liked a lot of the, I
mm-hmm.
liked the rituals. I
mm-hmm.
thought they were really helpful, and Missouri Synod Lutheran churches were not austere, like you see, like more in Mennonite.
Mm-hmm.
So they were, really took advantage of stained glass. Another thing they did was, for years, I want to say 50 years, they bought pipes for a pipe organ and shipped them over from Germany. So they had this relationship
mm-hmm.
with some place in Germany. They had picked out the organ they wanted, and they literally piece by piece shipped it over and
wow.
built it, and it became a part of that church. And that was typical
mm-hmm.
in Missouri Synod Lutheran churches. So there you see the tie
mm-hmm.
directly to Germany.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
That's cool. With communion, you said that they weren't able to take it until they were confirmed. So at that point in time, the church, I guess you would say, did not have an open table.
What they
others.
Would do for kids that were under communion age, they could come up with their parents for communion, and
mm-hmm.
they would be blessed, but they would not receive the sacrament.
Okay.
Is that what you were asking?
Yeah, it's just the Methodist Church, they always say they break the bread and whatever, and then they say this is an open table. So anyone,
uh-huh.
if you haven't been confirmed or you're not even a member of the church, you're able to take communion.
Oh, and that...
Which,
that was a no-no.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, you had to sign a card.
Oh,
if
really?
You were not a member
okay.
and you wanted to take communion, they had cards in the pews
mm-hmm.
that you had to fill out, and the elder had to look at the card and approve you in order for you to be able to take communion.
Wow. How big was the church? Fairly decent size.
Yeah, oh yeah, because you couldn't have had a second staff person, so probably maybe 1,000 people. Maybe not quite that many, but a large number of people.
Yeah, that's a lot.
Between, I'll say 500 to 800 people. Okay. That's probably more reasonable. But it was a good-sized church. And the other church in Kansas City that I was involved in with afterwards was over 1,000 members. These were big churches. Now, I don't know how their numbers are now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Wow. Did food figure into the religious life, such as like potlucks, that kind of stuff?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That was, and matter of fact, I have a story about a potluck where I'm a woman, and so but I'm in a leadership position, and so it was kind of like they were joking with me about you should have your husband bring something for the potluck because he's almost like the woman in the particular situation. And but the undercurrent was it was really my responsibility because I was a woman. So even though I was in a leadership position, I was expected to do to do more to meet the requirements. And I remember I didn't know how to cook that well.
Yeah.
And I remember I was in my early 20s and it was enough. I was presenting, I was doing things for church, and then you were expected to also bring food for like right after the services. And it was incredibly stressful. And I remember being really concerned about how the older women were going to view what I had brought and if it was going to be acceptable or not. It was a real... I did not find that to be a real supportive environment.
So they had meals after every service?
Not after every service, but I would say every special occasion.
Okay.
So Mother's Day, Father's Day... Valentine's Day, sometimes they just have a potluck to have a potluck. Sometimes they would serve meals. So like Easter morning, they would have an Easter breakfast, and the youth group would be responsible for putting that breakfast on. And as a minister of Christian education, because that was my role, was to be involved with the youth, I was largely in charge of making sure that thing went off well.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, does that kind of...
Yeah, definitely.
So there was a lot of focus on food.
Mm-hmm.
And at funerals and weddings, food was a huge component, and church members would bring tons of food for those receptions after weddings and funerals.
That's cool.
No.
Was volunteer labor used for any part of the life of the group and maintenance of its building?
Oh, yeah. Okay. For the life of the group? Yeah, the whole thing was built around volunteers. So all the people teaching Bible study, all the people in leadership positions. I mean, and we had some pretty prominent people in the community who, you know, we had an accountant who worked in another environment in her other life, and she actually was the accountant for the for the church. We had, we did hire a secretary, and we had a secretary on site who answered the phones and that kind of thing, but beyond that, the whole thing with volunteers. I mean, we had a huge group of volunteers who visited the sick. We had huge groups of volunteers who, eventually, they had a Meals on Wheels or a meals program on site, an on site meals program, and there were volunteers who staffed that program. So yeah, I mean. And I found that incredibly difficult as someone in the leadership position to try to muster up the support or the work of the volunteers, because that comes and goes. It's a very difficult thing to maintain. Yeah, it's important.
As far as maintenance, was there were volunteers?
There was
no,
there weren't.
There
was a staff person. They hired someone to do the maintenance.
What were the economic arrangements of the group, such as, like, how was money raised, or who made the spending decisions?
They had a committee. So they had, like, a management committee, and they had, it was always by group decision, and it was always, it was almost pretty democratic. I mean, you had to be, you were voted on in terms of what, so the congregation would have congregational meetings, and they would vote on who would be on these committees, and then they would serve for a year, and then they would do another vote, or maybe at most 2 years. So that's how all the leadership decisions were made, was in a group decision. And when they called, like I interned there, and then they offered the call to me. So when they call it a call, meaning you're called by God to serve at this church.
Okay.
And when they did that, the whole church had to vote. I was in competition with another man who was he had been interviewed and they had brought him in, and they were trying to make a decision about whether they were going to call him or me. And I had interned there, but I had thought, as a woman, I didn't, and he had more experience than I did. I wondered if I would get the call.
Mm-hmm.
So you get the call, and then you're asked to just say yes to the call or no.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's what they did. Then they hired me on as a staff person.
Okay.
Right? Interesting, not everybody would refer to it as a call from God kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
How was the money raised for the church?
They had a huge building fund. They rebuilt the whole sanctuary in the top. They started that process when I started there. I think it was from donors, from people that were members there. The kids, though, would have tons of activities to earn money, fundraising.
Mm-hmm.
So whether it was through car washes and bake sales and you name it, they were doing that to raise monies for like trips they might take to a youth gathering. But as far as the overall operation of the church, I would say it was the adults. You were required to tithe.
Mm-hmm.
I forgot to
yeah.
say that.
Yeah.
You know, 10%, 10 to 15, 15%. Mm-hmm. I think it might have been, it was more than 10%. You were asked to tithe between 10 and 15% of your income to the church. And we were a fairly well-off church. We were a big church, and people tithed. They contributed to the workings of the church.
Mm-hmm.
That's how that happened. Yeah.
Yeah.
So not a ton of fundraising except what the kids had to do.
Mm-hmm.
You're just primarily making it through the questions?
Yeah. This is good information, though.
So I answered some of the other questions.
Yeah, no, that's okay. That's great.
That's good.
That's great. What were the people like? Who are the unforgettable characters?
Well, I still remember the woman who, she was managing housing for up on Fort Leavenworth.
Mm-hmm.
So here she's this really competent woman, and she was then in a management position in the church.
Mm-hmm.
So, and she had a family, she had children, so it was like handling everything.
Yeah.
Jack of all trades.
Yeah.
And it was okay for a woman to do that because the role was not specifically religious.
Mm-hmm.
So she could function in that capacity. There was an older woman that was like really nurtured and was very supportive of me. And she, for many years, had gone to, well, for the years I was there, would come, get out.
Mm-hmm.
And then over even the short span of time I was working there, ended up shut in and not able to get out.
Oh, wow.
And so I would go and visit her.
Mm-hmm.
That was a really big component of my life in that church, as a leader. And then I worked a lot with adolescents, and there were a couple of kids that really stood out to me, and I tended to attract the kids that were on the fringe, so they weren't in the mainstream of the church.
Mm-hmm.
And so I found out later one of the kids that I had tried to reach out to, whose parents were not that involved in the church, but knew was friends of other kids that were going to the youth group, that he was indeed gay. And he had been exploring his gayness and had asked me questions about the church's stance on homosexuality.
Yeah.
And that still stands out. That's been over 20 years ago. And I remember at the time giving him the party line, which is, you know, the party line in the Missouri Synod is, we accept the sinner, but we hate the sin.
Mm.
And as I got older and moved into social work, I realized how ugly even that point of view is, and felt badly about that for him. And there were others where there were huge issues around drug abuse, and that some of these kids, they were troubled. Some of the people that were coming to church were really, and maybe that's true everywhere, or troubled families. I remember one family where the family spent beyond their means. They spent too much money, and we had scholarships for kids to go to daycare. And there was a committee, of course, that made the decision on who got the scholarships. And I really felt like this kid that they had could really benefit from it. And the family was really tight. And I can remember very well what the committee said, which was, these parents made bad decisions, and we're not going to reward their bad behavior with providing a scholarship for this kid. And my argument was, it's not the kid's fault, it's the parents' fault. Why can't we support and help this kid out in order to get him here? Even with that argument, they absolutely refused to consider that. They just thought, it was a real, Missouri Synod tends to lay a lot of guilt on people around their bad behavior. Remember, the whole notion is you're born sinful. It's not that you commit acts of sin. It is all of who you are. And without God, you're in hell. It's a very ugly kind of picture of what it means to be alive. But you asked me something else. What did you ask me? Memorable characters. So some of those families, so this family struggling, and then we refuse to help. This some of these adolescent kids reaching out for help, and we had these hard stances about homosexuality. And then some of the older people whom I thought were unforgettable and incredibly stalwart and giving and really decent human beings. But that's a mixed bag.
Yeah, it is.
It is a mixed bag.
It's really, I don't think I have any more questions. You answered pretty much everything that I was going to ask you.
Well, I hope it was helpful to you.
Yeah, thank you so much for meeting with me. That was interesting. I'm going to shut this off.
What? I forget those stories till I...